Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
With Shift Work, a podcast made in collaboration with RWCF and HRN, we're shifting the conversation about how the restaurant food you love makes its way to the table. Listen to and follow Shift Work on your favorite podcast app.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's episode, we have the incredible writers Matt Rodbard and Daniel Halsman of the new book, Food IQ. When food writer Matt Rodbard met chef Daniel Halsman while covering the opening of his restaurant, The Meatball Shop, on New York's Lower East Side, it was a match made in questions. More than a decade later, the pair have remained steadfast friends. They write a popular column together and talk, text, and DM about food consistently. Now their new book, Food IQ, they're sharing their passion and deep curiosity for food, home cooking, and the food world zeitgeist with everyone. Later in the show, we have a show from our archives with the artist and incredible muse, Juliana Bartwick. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes on HRN.
We talk about food. Talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Mm-hmm.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. Please excuse my hoarse, non-COVID related voice this week. I was screaming into the void this weekend and it has not come back. I am so deeply excited for today's episode. We have a friend of Snacky Tunes, Matt Rodbard, and his partner in crime, Daniel Halsman, authors of the new book, Food IQ, 100 Questions, Answers, and Recipes to Raise Your Cooking Smarts. Here on the show, gents, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hey, buddy.
Thanks so much for having us.
Matt, I think this is like 3, 4, 5 times on the show. One of our most frequent returning guests, and no surprise because every few years you seem to put out something incredible. And I just want to start by saying this book is amazing. I had so much fun reading it. I tried to take notes to guide our conversation, and then I realized I was just copying the whole book. So it's really done its job. But I want to go back a little bit before, because our guests know Matt, but we don't know Daniel. So Daniel, maybe you want to give a little background on yourself. And Matt, also, you can do a little refresher too.
A little background on myself. My name is Daniel Halsman. I was born in Boonton, New Jersey when I was I'm 42 years old. I don't have a lot of hair on my head. I got gorgeous blue eyes, according to my mama. I started working in kitchens when I was 13 years old, delivering food at a pizzeria across the street from my house. And then got real lucky, and a friend of mine's father was a maitre d' at a fancy restaurant. So I got to start working at a, you know, like fancy Michelin star restaurant very, very young, and fell in love with the kitchen and the camaraderie of the cooks and the, you know, everything restaurant. I opened a restaurant late in my 20s and in San Francisco. And then my buddy Mike Chernow said, "Hey, man, I want you to move to New York and open this restaurant with me." And I moved back to my hometown where I'd grown up, and opened the meatball shop, which was a kind of really well accepted and exciting. And then the rest is history, I guess. Opening restaurants, got suckered into it.
And Matt, a quick refresher for our audience and some of the books that you have talked about on previous episodes.
It's nice to be back on the show. I feel we were just at Roberto's the other day, but that was like maybe 8 years ago. No, I wrote a book with Dookie Hong called Koreatown, and I think that was probably one of the last times I was on the show. And I'm the editor-in-chief of Taste, which is a food and culture publication that we just celebrated our 5th year of publishing. But right now, it's Food IQ. I mean, this book that Daniel and I have been working on, we know each other for 10 years. So this book is 10 years in the making. Our friendship goes back to when I met Daniel at the opening of the meatball shop down on Stanton Street in Lower East Side, New York. I was there just to interview these two young chefs who were opening this restaurant. And Halsman was like a magnet at the time. He was a magnetic, curious, full of life gentleman who gave me a lot of inspiration over the years to think deeper about food.
It's a really incredible partnership, one from the culinary standpoint and one from the editorial standpoint. And I love the intro, how it's just like Matt asked Daniel a million questions, and this is the impetus for the book. Daniel, on the receiving end of it, was any question too small? Or were you happy to field all of Matt's queries?
Was any question? I think you're giving me credit. Fielding his queries were actually getting called out by him when my answers didn't live up to, you know, necessarily what I would expect of even myself. That one of the greatest parts about Matt as a true journalist, he usually knows the answer to the question he's going to ask before he asks the question. And so he's a very, very well-researched journalist. So when my answers aren't necessarily true, and I'm very glad to have a partner who calls me out when I'm not up to snuff.
And what's a good example of Matt
you already knowing the answer and just setting Daniel up for absolute facepalm.
I mean, let's talk about tuna. So I knew that, like, I was asking, like, okay, so, like, how do you get the most out of a can of tuna? I knew deep down that Ortiz is the brand. Like, I knew that tuna packed in oil was the way to eat tuna. Like, that's the way I've always kind of done it since I've been, you know, writing about food. I mean, you know, last 10 years. But the kind of beauty of the way we worked through these questions was I learned a lot about tuna conserva talking to Daniel, and about the way you can, like, cook with tuna conserva and put in grilled rapini and chickpeas and make a really great salad with it. And thinking about it as not something for a sandwich, but for, like, its own side. And this was, like, 2.5-3 years ago when we started thinking about tuna conserva. So yes, I did know the answer to that. We were not going with the bumblebee packed in saltwater variety, but
which, by the way, also happens to be delicious and is, you know, a staple in my cupboard. It's just like cooking. We use different products for different outcomes. I wouldn't necessarily use super fancy tuna for a tuna sandwich, and I wouldn't use the cheap stuff to highlight, you know, my salad niçoise.
I was born and raised Jewish household, tuna and water, COVID convert of tuna and olive oil and never going back. So I was delighted to see that discussion in the book. And I want to get to the book in 1 second, but when did this start to take shape? When did 10 years of conversations go, this should be a book?
I was going to make an off, an inappropriate joke. So I'm glad you cut in.
I guess that's how it goes. But no, I was going to say, seriously, we started writing a column for Savour, and I had to give Max Falkowitz a shout out. Max was an editor there and gave Daniel and I a shot to write about some of our favorite neighborhood restaurants in New York that happened to be from Southeast Asia, Asia, East Asia, South Asia, Indian, Japanese, Chinese. And we wrote this column and we kind of started developing these recipes around our travels around the boroughs. So we started creating together and writing together as writing partners. And that evolved into a column on taste, which we wrote for a couple of years called 100 Questions for My Friend the Chef. And out of those columns, we wrote 2 columns together. We kind of were like, well, maybe there's something more. What do you think, Daniel?
I think that basically sums it up. You know, the idea of the best restaurants. I'm a restaurant guy, so my analogy is the best restaurants always start small and grow into something amazing. You know what I mean? It's like if your sales are great right off the bat, you can only go downhill from there. This was one of those ideas where we started working and putting together something, and it's grown into this, which feels very special.
Like I said, the book is amazing. What I love about it is it's not really like a foodie 1.0, at least my own interpretation, not really like a foodie 1.0 book. Like, you're not picking it up and being like, how to boil water. The questions that you attack are actually questions that I have asked and Googled over and over again. Another COVID thing is I taught myself how to cook with a cast iron because I absolutely ruined it. I'm afraid to touch a wok after what I did to my first one 10 years ago, potatoes, et cetera. And we'll get into it. How did you narrow down the questions? How were you able to kind of be like, the audience for these questions is such, and these are the type of questions that we're going to go after versus a much more introductory book, which I don't believe this is.
Oh, I'm waiting for you because you're the foodie 2.0 guy. That's like your whole Matt. That's Matt's whole world. He was like, you know, we're writing this cookbook. We need to identify first, like a really, you know, like a great journalist. You say, who am I writing this for? And he was identifying that, you know, there's 1,000 books that teach you how to do the basics. And so what is a non-Googleable question? What's a question that, you know, that you really need to trust the person who's answering it in order to get to the source of the information. And that's where, you know, you should talk about the Foodie 2.0.
Yeah, I agree. I think the point of our statement that the foodie has won, or the Foodie 2.0, is that everyone thinks about food these days, and it's not about boiling water, and it's not about the basic knife skills, because that stuff is not really great as a piece of content. It's not interesting. Foodies these days want a little more. They want to know about the different types of potatoes to use for the different scenarios. They want to know about like the history of gochujang. They want to know about like deeper things, and really they have this inquisitive nature that really we are striving to attack with these 100 questions. So some of them, yeah, are pretty esoteric. Like we talk about growing sprouts. It's the last question in the book. And, you know, it's a little hippy dippy. And I respect it, though, because we think that making falafels with homemade or homegrown sprouts is like the greatest thing. And we think the Foodie 2.0 are people who want to grow their own sprouts.
Yeah, I mean, go on, Chef.
No, I was just going to say, I think a big part of the book was this is about questions that will help you if you read them in the kitchen. Outside of the kitchen, if you just want to understand about food, but more so, you know, it's like even if you don't grow your own sprout, understanding the process will help you be a better shopper, a better restaurant eater, a better talker about food, a better informed consumer, which is better for restaurants, it's better for farmers, and it's better for your budget. The understanding of how and of the why behind and the how we do things allows you to be a more kind of like free and confident entrepreneurial about food in general.
That's very well said. And reading this book, I don't want to sound like I'm fanning out too much, but it already made me think like, well, I kind of figured this part on my own. This seemed unattainable to me, but if they're writing about this, then I feel that I can actually go after this piece of cooking and expand my repertoire. And it was like kind of leveraging up on knowledge. Speaking about knowledge, it'd be very easy for the two of you just to be like, we are the outright experts in this and write 100 answers to 100 questions. But that is not the case. There are a number of guest experts in the book. Tell me a little bit about who lent you their advice and knowledge and how you put them all together to answer some of the more difficult questions outside of your knowledge.
It's a great question because we definitely know a lot of shit. I'm just kidding. We actually don't know a lot. We needed other voices in the book, and we certainly, I kind of took my journalistic instinct there and got in touch with a bunch of contributors and people I knew around food. And really it's about getting into these topics that maybe we've experienced ourselves firsthand, but it isn't really our lives. So for example, we talked to Marwan Irani, who's awesome. I don't know if he's been on your show. He's from Chaipani.
He was in the book. He was in the Snackytunes book. He was amazing.
So we asked him about curry powder and the myth around curry powder, and how curry powder is not really a thing, how it's actually more like Madras curry and vadavan in French cooking. And really we had this really cool conversation, and we distilled it down into three questions. And there's examples of that from, you know, Pre Krishna and Therese Nelson, the founder of Black Culinary History, Yoda Mandalangi. Our friend Roy Choi talked about the exploding Korean American cooking scene. So these experts really sprinkled throughout the book bring really needed outside voice and perspective.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of areas where we were very lucky to get to learn, probably even more than folks reading the book, because we spent, you know, just tons of time researching. And at the end of the day, having somebody who lives a culture, you know, speak to the food that they know and love, is going to be so much more poignant than us trying to translate it for them.
We're going to take a quick musical break. We're going to play a song from the archives, and then we'll be back with Matt and Daniel here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Ooh.
Let's get into the questions. There are 100 questions in here. It was really hard for me to pick one to start, just to begin with. So I want to start with the myths, because I think that's a really great section, because you get to a certain point in your career where you're past Foodie 1.0 and you've maybe entered into Foodie 2.0 and you feel afraid or imposter syndrome. And you answer and anticipate a lot of things that might just be in people's heads. So let's start with, should I feel embarrassed to cook with canned beans? Because I'm in the South and I feel like there is such a debate over pre-soaking your beans versus canned beans. What is the myth here? What do you debunk? Should we or should we not?
So canned beans, this derived from, kind of a troll, Daniel
this is like one of the main things that inspired the whole book was me busting out chops about being embarrassed. Cause I'm like, here we are writing this column for Fancy Magazine for fancy food people. And you're using canned beans. What gives?
Yeah. On my Instagram stories, he called me out publicly, and shamed me, for using canned chickpeas. But really we sat down, and had a real conversation about canned beans. And we come to the conclusion that, Daniel, what do you have to say?
Just like everything else in the world, almost every product has its place. And canned beans are absolutely exceptional when used in the right way. I wouldn't necessarily highlight a canned beans as the centerpiece of the plate, but they absolutely work well for a myriad of applications. Myriad of applications or just myriad applications?
Myriad applications, I think.
Yeah, there's no of there. What a weird word. No, I sound so smart, except when I don't use it right, then I just sound like a schmo. Put me back in the pizzeria.
All right, let's go on to another section. This sounds fancy. This sounds intimidating. What is it? Will you break down some of the most iconic dishes that people go, I'm going to stay away from it? What is Kobe beef and is it really better? A wonderful question for anyone that's gone out and been questioned with, do I get the upsell or not? Chef, we'll start with you. What is it and is it better?
So, you know, I think we get into the idea that what is Kobe beef? It's a great marketing term. And if you go to, if you've had Japanese Wagyu beef, that's been, you know, that's been raised for it, the maximum amount of intramuscular fat, you have this extraordinary piece of meat that isn't like anything else you've ever had. It's not interchangeable with a steak. It's a different food product that's can be incredibly delicious. But like a lot of fancy things, you know, people have been kind of stealing the name and labeling stuff Kobe that isn't necessarily Kobe. And you're not always getting what you're necessarily paying for or even or being promised.
Matt, anything to add?
Yeah, definitely. I'll add, I mean, A5 Wagyu, Japanese Wagyu is dope. Like we love it. We've had it. We've had fortunate meals around New York and LA where we've had it presented to us or seared it ourselves in our kitchens. But there's American Wagyu. There's domestic Wagyu that takes the cow from Japan. I believe it's a variety of brown cattle. I'm not remembering the name, but it is bred and raised in America, and it has the marbling and the intensity that that we covet with beef, and it's great. And I have to echo Daniel's point about the marketing of Kobe. It's been marketed. I think Anthony Bourdain was probably the one who stabbed the dagger into the Kobe beef marketing campaign when he said, you know, Kobe sliders were for douchebags. Like that was kind of a funny little anecdote from his riffs, but really he had a point. Like there really wasn't much more going on with Kobe beef outside of that name. So I think it's delicious beef though.
New section, 12 favorite essential life-changing things to cook forever. This has been a big debate between Darren, my co-host and twin brother, and I. How do I scramble eggs like a chef? I used to do a hard and fast. He did a slow, and I have now become a very slow convert. And I'm remiss to say that it is infinitely better. But chef, again, we'll start with you. How do I scramble an egg like a chef?
Well, you know, depends, I guess, if you're fast order chef or you're talking Danielle Belude. Look, Jacques, you go online and you watch Jacques Pepin make an omelet or scramble eggs, and it's a thing of beauty. And that's definitely the inspiration that I take from and where I've learned to scramble eggs. I think he kind of taught the world to love a scrambled egg and how to make it properly and how to turn it into an omelet. So I'm a soft scramble guy myself. But, you know, there's nothing better than like sitting at that diner and watching the guy crack the eggs and chop them up on the flat top, a little brown on the outside, maybe some melted cheap Swiss cheese and ham in there. You know, a Western omelet or a Denver omelet make a guy happy. So I'm American through, you know.
I'll just add that when I grew up, I was a brown omelet guy. Like I was a hard omelet. My dad made it that way. But then we worked on a story on Taste about Jacques Pepin's famous omelets, and Joshua David Stein wrote it. It was great, a great piece. And that YouTube video that Daniel refers to from like 1993 of Jacques making an omelet with just a fork is so legendary.
Scrambling like a nonstick pan with a metal fork. You're just like, Jesus, French man, you're so great at what you do, but please.
I know, it's so French. And I think I was a convert after I watched that for the fifth time.
Incredible. All right. Ingredients, misunderstood, undiscovered, overlooked, and underappreciated. There's so many good ones here because I really have asked these questions so many times. Let's go with the controversial one. Should I cook with MSG?
Good question. We thought about this question a lot. We really wanted to make sure we did our homework. We talked to Helen Rosner, who wrote this really remarkable piece about visiting an MSG factory for the New Yorker. So we have a sidebar interview with her. But the bottom line is that MSG is everywhere, and the Chinese restaurant syndrome that, you know, MSG causes headaches, et cetera, it's been proven time and again to be a pretty xenophobic attack and full of junk science. As I was saying, MSG is everywhere. It's in potato chips. It's in, you know, sodas. And it's definitely in most of the food we eat at restaurants because restaurants cook with MSG all the time. We personally like MSG, but we like MSG with a recipe. It's not just about, you know, throwing some MSG in willy-nilly into your stew. It's about cutting it with salt. We have like a recipe to cut MSG with salt.
Yeah, I think that MSG is really misunderstood. It's naturally occurring in a lot of instances, so we consume it in a lot of ways that we wouldn't suspect. But when you're using it in its pure form, it can be a bit overwhelming. And so our goal is to say, this is an amazing ingredient that you shouldn't be afraid of, but you should learn how to use it so that you're maximizing its effect and making your food as delicious as it can be.
All right, let's do one last question. Weekend cooking projects, is the juice worth the squeeze? And controversial again, COVID. What is sourdough? What is more to say about it? What about all these bros making bread?
I think I understand why it's so magical and so alluring and so many people got into it, because when you first take flour and water and you capture living organisms that are floating around in the world and your bread comes out of the oven and you think, man, this is so much greater than the sum of its part. I mean, this is as close to alchemy as anything in real life that I've ever can imagine. So like I'm all for it. Do I prefer sourdough in every instance? Absolutely not. It's a really distinct and strong flavor. Again, an ingredient to be used in moderation for what you want it for. The great thing that we did with Food IQ that I'm really proud of is when you do have a sourdough starter, you got a lot of waste. So we looked at what can we use the waste for, so that this amazing byproduct that's very delicious that costs a lot of money because you're constantly mixing in new flour and throwing it away. What can we use that for that'll give us something that that we can use?
And I'll have to add, the way the book is structured is really an immersive experience. And as you know, we have the answer about sourdough that Daniel just outlined, but we also have a recipe with each of these questions. It's important to point that out because we believe that to really understand the question, you got to make something, or at least like walk through the recipe and rock through the steps. So we have this great cracker recipe using that extra sourdough starter where it's not bread, it's not pancakes, it's actually crackers that you can make ahead of time for a party or just to have around for snacking. And so to fully understand why sourdough is not just about the bros and the tech guys making bread, it's about actually doing more with your starter.
Put in my place. Asked a dumb question, got two smart answers, just like I feel a little fly on the wall for your 10 years of conversations. The other beautiful thing about this book are the illustrations. They're really fun. They're great. They add a really nice layer to the also incredible photography. Who was the illustrator, and was there any inspiration or art direction you gave to them to capture the fun that this book carries?
I think that, first of all, we had there's a guy named Miguel Villalobos. When Matt and I were talking about an illustrator for the book, traditional illustration, we were looking through a lot of talented people and we were thinking, we really want to give somebody the opportunity to have fun with this, and to showcase their art. Miguel does have a good amount of illustration, experience, but he's a fine artist. And it was his sense of humor and, he has a unique way of looking at the world. So when we were talking about questions, he saw something in us and in what we were talking about, and in the answer that might have been a bit unusual, and illustrated it. So we really, after the first couple of conversations, said, listen, you're amazing. Why don't you just run with it? Scribble all over the pages, and then we will give you feedback if there's anything that we want to see more of, but we let him really express his art. And I think that's the greatest collaborations are when people trust each other, and get to really have as much fun as they want. And you get something that, like sourdough, is greater than the sum of its parts.
Nice. And I'll talk about our photography. We had a cookbook veteran, Ed Anderson, photographing, and Ed is such a pro, and he shot the book with Daniel in Daniel's house in Venice, California. And Ed is mostly a travel photographer. He shoots books for Katie Parla and he shoots books for Brad Parson. He's always on the road. So I guess during COVID, he couldn't really be on the road. So he found this project, our project, to shoot in California, and just really just absolutely pleasure to work with.
Yeah, I feel like every now and then you get a team of folks that come together. Because Lizzie had so Matt was really insistent on having somebody have a cohesive vision for the art direction of the book and help us along, and hired a person that he had worked. You'd worked with Lizzie before?
She's from 10 Speed Press. She's an in-house art director, and we had known each other, but we found Lizzie Allen. She really helped us bring the book to life.
That is truly incredible. And Chef, to your point, you know, we talk so much about the common language between chef and musicians and how they're able to articulate their desires through various creative practices. And it's also amazing to see it when it comes to artist to chef, which we haven't really covered so much. But obviously, if you were probably in their shoes and like, look, let me just cook you a meal. You tell me if you don't like it. You get the same thing, and it really has its own strong identity. So it's great to hear that it came from almost no direction except choose your own adventure. I would be remiss to not have both of you on here. Question 101, which is, what are your playlists and what are you listening to when you're cooking and or doling out advice? And it can either be a record, an artist, a station, but I'm so curious to what you listen to while doing this, or when you were doing your final cramming last moment copy edits for this book, what you're cranking just to get through it.
I love this question so much. I used to be a music writer. I worked at, publications and honestly, my musical taste is pretty out there and eclectic. Sloan is like one of my favorite bands ever. They're most underrated. They're probably the greatest band in the history of the world. I'm just going to say that, Sloan. But really, I think when writing the book, I was listening to K-Jazz a lot, which is a Long Beach, California jazz station. I love a lot of their morning, the DJs there. So that's one. And then Turnstile. I listened to that Turnstile album a lot. I listened to Magdalena Bay a lot, too. I actually like... a lot of, I would call it more contemporary music, which is a terrible word, but I love modern music. I think Arlo Parks is probably my favorite album of the year. And I have to shout out Westerman from 2 years ago. Westerman is slept on. So that was my burst of music right there. I'm sorry. I just had to do that.
Wow. I'm just like, I listened to Sly and the Family Stone on repeat for the last 12 years straight. Gets me amped up.
Perfect. All right. Well, Matt, Daniel, thank you so much. Where can people find the book, get your newsletters? You're doing weekly questions or answers to questions as well. How can people follow along, get all the information and more? Where do they go? How do they follow you?
They can visit foodiq.co. We do a weekly newsletter. It's really fun. We take a lot of questions from readers. It's just a lot of, like, Daniel and I hop on the Zoom and do these questions every couple of weeks. And you can buy the book where you buy books.
Yeah. I mean, you should definitely, if you are so inclined to, go to a local bookseller, most of them should have it. We're lucky to be published with a publisher that has wide reaching.
Shout them out. Shout out your publisher.
Harper Wave, who's done an absolutely extraordinary job for us and been extremely supportive, and everybody on their team has been wonderful. And so, you know, we're lucky to be with somebody that's mainstream enough to get the book out there for us. And then, obviously all the online booksellers, support the book, which has really been great. So, you know, the goal for us is to inspire people to love food even more, cook more, talk about food. So whether you buy the book or not, as long as you're chopping those onions, God bless you.
Amazing. Fine chop? Hard chop?
Finely chopped. You got to find, I know I'm a rough chopper RoboCoop kind of guy. You know, it's like Cuisinart or kill.
Amazing. Well, thank you guys for joining. We're going to play another song from our archives, and then we'll be back with the second half of Snacky Tunes here on HRN. Oh,
I wanna build a house with you, a house with you, a house with you, a home, so we can be alone. And I've been running, I've been hiding, I've been falling down and climbing back up where they think they belong. Oh, let's go. And I know that you wouldn't try to tell me what you don't. Can be alone, 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 slipping on my shoes, my tongue is swole, my lips are bruised, and I can't get up the hill. And I've been jumping through some leaves and chopping down some cherry trees, so I, oh, so I can tell, so I can tell the truth. Your throat. I wanna build a house with you, a house with you, a house with you. I wanna build a house with you so we can be alone, so we can be alone.
Kiki Luya, the Executive Director of Restaurant Workers Community Foundation, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Shift Work. In the last 6 months, some 6,500 restaurants have closed their doors, and there's never been a time when restaurants and their 12 million workers have been more vulnerable. It's time to transform hospitality. With Shift Work, a podcast made in collaboration with RWCF and HRN, we're shifting the conversation about how the restaurant food you love makes its way to the table. What does it really take to make that experience happen? And who are the countless workers responsible? We're talking porters, cleaning crew, prep cooks, servers, baristas, hosts, bartenders, barbacks, managers, sommeliers, and chefs. I'll also introduce you to organizations that are leading industry transformation. We'll discuss mental health, fair pay, racial justice, and how hospitality can change for the better. We need it. Listen to and follow Shift Work on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back, Snacky Tunes. You want to introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Juliana Barwick.
I'm Nemai. I'm backing up the lovely Juliana Barwick.
Nemai is one of my best friends, and she's in Prince Rama, which is one of the best bands in the entire world.
Stop.
Just like keep going. So I have to say that your music is some of the most beautiful music I've ever heard. When Hannah sent it over to me to be like, oh, would you ever consider this for the radio show? I was like, absolutely. And then, first it was duh. And then, then I was like, it's like very specific. And then when the Iceland, I read about you recording in Iceland and Sigur Rós, and then I was like, oh, now it begins to make sense.
Yeah. It was a match made in heaven, I think.
Yeah. When were you over there?
Spring 2012.
Amazing. What's it like being over there, just recording music and being in the wild?
It's surreal. Every day I was like pinching myself, like, wow, you are in Iceland and making music. Life is grand.
How did that like friendship start?
Alex sent me an email. Alex Summers, who ended up producing it. Alex of you know, Yonzi and Alex and. But Alex has done a bunch of different things. He's started producing for more people, and he's done a lot of like mixing and recording for Sigur Rós and all of their like satellite projects. So he sent me an email, just like, we love your music and we would love to do something with you one day. And I ran a few laps around the couch, and then I was like, woo! Yes, and I sent an email back, and we just talked all year. That was 2011, so we talked all year long and made plans for me to come over and do it.
How many times did you have to rewrite that email?
Actually, it was like a total knee jerk reaction, and I just said yes with like 15 exclamation points.
Yeah, I was
points.
About to ask how many exclamation points.
Yeah, I was like, I can't control the nerdiness. I'm just going to let it flow.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's better just to not play it cool. Just be like, fuck it.
Yeah, they're going to find out anyway, so.
Like 2 minutes in, like, you're going to be like, your knees will be shaking, like, tears running down your face at the airport, just being like.
Exactly. Yeah, so, yeah, I think I responded just instantly. As soon as I saw the email, I just responded.
You're like, cool. I can't even imagine getting, like, just be like, oh, let me check my email and just getting.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest ones ever, so.
Oh, were there others?
couple others. But, yeah, I, up until that point, all my solo-y stuff was, like, bedroom recordings. With no one watching or listening or anything at all.
Did they say how they found out about your music?
Nope.
Hmm. And you never asked?
Nope.
Don't push your luck. Okay. Don't push your luck. Just get in there. Let's hear a song.
Yeah, let's hear a song.
Okay, cool. So this first one is One Half.
Come around me, I was waiting for love's way. silent cheering.
Yeah.
That was really great. This is like a perfect. There's like certain records that you like winter records. Like I imagine like 9 degrees out and like bundled up and the sky is purple.
Come on. Come on. We're not there yet.
No, but I'm saying when that happens. No.
When that happens, I'm leaving.
No. Yeah. When that happens, this record will be on play. There's just certain records that are like made for certain seasons.
Yeah, I was kind of like, I mean, we recorded it in, you know, spring of 2012, and it didn't come out until August of last year, 2013. I felt like it was a wintry record. Yeah. But things happen, and we had to release it in August. But
that's fine.
Yeah,
that's fine.
It's kind of wintry to me also. So.
Well, for all the Snacky Tune fans out there, they can get this ready for winter.
Yeah.
You were saying before that was your mom on the backing track?
Yeah.
Oh. What's that about?
Well, she's... has a beautiful, beautiful voice, and I grew up listening to her sing, you know, all the time.
Was it professional, or she just had a good voice?
She just has a great voice. And I just always wanted her on a record. And I'd taken, like, my sister to Australia, and we were, like, in a city every day, and I took my dad to France and Portugal, and we were in a city every day. And it was my turn to take my mom somewhere, but she's not kind of like a city-a-day kind of lady. And I just thought, this is perfect. She should go to Iceland with me and be on the record. And
was she there the entire time?
No, not the entire time. I went twice, so she went the first time with me in February, and then I came back and did about 5 or 6 more weeks of work on it with Alex in May.
Tough. Real
terrible
sacrifice.
Did you delve into Icelandic cuisine at all? Because they have some funky stuff over there.
Not a ton. I saw signs a lot that was like, our special today is whale and puffin, and I was like, oh, that makes me want to cry.
They have this, I think it's like this rotten fish that they bury.
Oh yeah, I can't remember what the name of that is.
Lufthansa? Something like that. I don't know.
And they also,
pony.
It's one step up from Scrapple.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like the fermented shark.
Yeah,
fermented
shark stuff. Yeah.
And it's like I've watched a ton of Anthony Bourdain over the years, and that's the one thing that he was like, I can't. No. Like, I'll eat anything else. Like.
It sounds terrifying.
Yeah, so I don't know.
Fermented shark.
I'm sorry, I didn't get too adventurous with the puffin or the fermented shark.
I don't even think you need to apologize. I think I'm adventurous either, and I think I would probably.
You know, the upsetting thing is they serve the puffin with the head still on.
No!
Get out of here. You're fired.
That's so cute.
And then you also had a Chilton's choir on there, right? Which is like.
That's a fancy way of saying that.
You conscripted some children.
That's a fancy way of saying that Goggy is the bassist for Sigaros. He has a beautiful teenage daughter, and she has some beautiful teenage friends, and they came to the Sung Lane studio, and we recorded with them for a day, and paid them in pizza and ice cream.
Yes.
That's all teenagers want anyway.
They were stoked. They were like, yes.
That's what they would have spent their money on. They would have, you just cut out the ordering.
Exactly. Yeah. And they'd recorded on some Sigaros stuff too. So yeah, that's where the.
No child labor laws in Iceland.
I guess not.
Yeah. Should we hear another song?
Yeah, let's do another song.
Cool. I guess we can do that.
What's this one called?
This one is Crystal Lake. Crystal Lake. Thank you. Yay, yeah. Nimai.
That's a good, like, do you wink a lot when you finish songs?
I only wink at Juliana. Oh. A very special friendship.
Oh, yeah.
How did you two meet?
We met in Istanbul.
Istanbul.
Really?
Yep.
Both of our bands were playing together at this festival.
Okay. What festival?
I don't know. You remember? I think it was in a different language.
Okay.
I don't remember.
I think Bant Mag put it together.
Okay.
I can't remember the exact name of the festival, but...
It was so fun.
It was so fun, and every people in Istanbul are just freaking awesome, and that place is ridiculously beautiful. And it was me and Prince Rama and Moon Duo and just a bunch of, like, really, really amazing people.
Psych, get out there.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And then we just kind of, like, followed each other around. We were at Northeast together.
We were in Australia together.
And we did like, the Sugar Mountain Festival in Melbourne and Mona Foma in Tasmania. We were just... I was following them around a lot.
How was Sugar Mountain?
How was it?
Great.
Yeah.
That was off the hook. John Mouse played. So and
he
kind
of fell in love with your sister, I think.
Him and my sister had, like...
We're talking forever.
Yeah, they were
some festival love sessions?
No, they are both, like, complete brainiacs, so they were just bouncing off of each other. It was like watching ping pong.
Yeah, well, Julianne and I just sit there and, like, wink at each other.
Yeah, we're like, hey, I like your nail polish.
Yeah, John Mouse and her sister were talking about, like, the universe.
Yeah, it went all over the place.
And we're just like, cool.
Everything.
So much winking. I blew an eye out, actually.
My falsies fell off.
So, what's next? Tours? Musings? Wandering around in a snow-filled New York City?
Oh, I hope not.
No.
It's coming.
It's going to be brutal winter. I can feel it.
Even worse than last one, because I missed last year's winter. Same. And everyone was like, you're lucky you're not here, because it just
sucks.
It was
a nightmare. Yeah.
Nightmare. I missed it, too. It wouldn't stop snowing. I don't get it. I mean, it means I can listen to your album longer, but...
What's next for me is fun.
I'll be there.
Oh, sweet.
You want to hang out?
Yeah, sweet. Duh.
How's your winking game, Darren?
Don't worry. You have some time to work on it.
Yeah. Hey, guys, can't go out tonight. Working on my winking game for fun.
Me and J-Bar are going to wink at each other.
Wink.
Fun. And then on November 20th, I'm playing a lighthouse, on the cliffs of Norway, and that's real.
That is a real sentence.
Yeah, and I get to sleep there.
Wait, what?
I don't even
alone,
know.
Alone, I must survive the night.
Yeah.
If you survive the night, you can play a brunch set the next day.
Exactly. Yeah,
What is it?
Wait, I don't, it's just like a one-off.
It's a casual one-off.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm playing Le Guess Who, which is my Europe booking agent's festival that he does in Utrecht. Le Guess Who. And I'm doing the, like, 24-hour drone fest with, like, William Basinski and a few other awesome people.
Can you stand for the whole thing?
Probably not, unless they give me treats.
Yeah. Like Red Bull? 5-hour energy drink?
No, thank you. That stuff makes me... I haven't even ever tried that because I know it would make my heart feel really bad.
You never know until you try.
It makes me feel like my heart is sitting outside of my chest.
Yeah.
Like in a good way?
I don't think I'd like that feeling. Look how cute this little girl is.
This little girl wants to be in the
mirror. It's always the kids that can, like, look in.
So cute.
Yeah.
So that's November. And then December is just holiday time, hanging out with my little nephew and stuff.
Where are you from?
I was born in Louisiana, but my whole family's in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and my sister just had the cutest baby in the world last Halloween, so that's where...
Oh, do you know what the kid's going as this year?
I think he's going to be Charlie Brown.
Okay.
Probably has the right haircut.
Yeah.
It's not going to be too hard. I'm just going to get the shirt, and he basically looks like it.
all right, well, we want to make sure we get one more
before we have Ben Stevenson join.
Where can people find you? Instagram, Twitter, Smoke Signals...
It's Juliana Barwick, Twitter, Instagram, website.
No J-Bar?
Not yet.
That's your future hip-hop career.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when I get the cover of Us Weekly. I'll be J-Bar.
J-Bars, Dirty Laundry.
When I start dating, who do I want to date?
Zac Efron.
Harry Styles.
Oh, yeah, Harry Styles.
Yeah. No one can see how much you're blushing on the radio.
Even though he's like 20 years younger than me, no big deal.
That's cool. Whatever.
Yo.
Yeah.
It's never too late to be a cougar.
Yeah.
You can do that your whole life.
Yeah. Get after it. So what's this last track you're going to play for us?
We're going to do prize winning because it's drummy and that's what Nimi does.
Also, my sister did a remix of this song.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a Matrimony Remixes EP that I put out on Asthmatic Kitty.
And love that label.
Like,
love
it. I feel like people don't really know about this Matrimony Remixes EP, but it's pretty dope. It has Tarika from Prince Rama did one, and Diplo and Lunas did one. My friend Brian did one. My friend Roberto did one. And
is that their DJ names, My Friend Brian?
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good, though.
Alias Pale, Elato Negro, Prince Rama, Diplo and Lunas is pretty dope.
It's pretty
great. Diplo guy, watch out for him.
Yeah.
Big things in 2015.
Yeah, he's doing okay for himself.
Okay. He's doing fine.
I think he's gonna be okay.
Yeah. All right. Well.
That's the impression I get.
Well, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.